But I think in times of change, which is what we're going through now, because it's all changing so quickly, you do need someone to say, but there might be another way, or to question things or be curious or to say why. And it's funny, in my book, I talk about the rough diamond scheme that I set up, because I specifically set it up because I wanted some of that fearlessness from kids who are about to be expelled from schools. Because I'd noticed within Ogilvy that they were always hiring white middle-class Oxford educated. And I actually, to do the changes I needed them to think maybe there's another way and question it and be curious and be a pain in the arse.
This week's guest is author, consultant, speaker, mentor and curiosity-charged connector, Nicole Yershin. Since starting her career in advertising at age 19, Nicole's been forging a path of change, driving digital disruption inside traditional ad agencies and beyond. Hired to initiate innovation at advertising institution Ogilvy & Mather Group, her lab inspired innovation across brands such as Amex, IBM, BP, Selfridges, Unilever and British Airways. With an Amazon bestseller, Rough Diamond, to her name, Nicole recently launched her innovation consultancy, NYC, Nicole Yershin Collective. The aim? To help organisations embrace radical digital transformation using her experience, her why not attitude and ability to translate business problems into innovation opportunities and real business value. In this episode, Nicole is joined by her collective partner, John Caswell, who's helped businesses solve their big, gnarly problems by thinking visually using a technique he's designed called structured visual thinking. I hope you enjoy this episode of Maverick Thinking with Nicole Yershin and John Caswell. Today I'm joined by Nicole Yershin.
Hello.
Hello, Nicole.
Hello.
Nicole and I go back a long time, 2006 to be precise, when we both worked in big agencies, Nicole at Ogilvy and myself at McCann. Nicole has recently set up her own entrepreneurial venture, which we'll get into, called NYC Collective, appropriately sitting here in NYC discussing NYC. And beside Nicole is John Caswell from Group Partners.
Hello.
Hi, welcome both of you.
It's great to be here.
So, I'd like to kick off, Nicole, talking before we get into talking about what you're doing with John and your innovation initiatives. I'd like to go back to your beginning of your journey.
Okay. No,
obviously, where
That's
you
a
were
long
born.
Time ago.
I know it is for all of us. But I'd love to sort of understand a bit more about how your journey started, the influences on you, your attitude to life, in your childhood, your upbringing, whether it be your parents, your teachers, or some other individual in your life that injected in you your sense of belief and direction.
Mm. Okay, so going way back, the person that really stands out consciously was my dad, is my dad. And he's kind of a media legend. He was one of the first in the UK to set up media independence and take media out of agencies. And the first time when I started...
That was back in the 80s.
Yeah. First time when I... And also he was part of the Mad Men days in the late 60s and working at CDP.
In one of the great agencies.
Yeah, he was the media director there. So
for people that don't know the acronym, call it Dickinson Pierce.
Call it Dickinson and Pierce.
Pierce, that was it.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was amazing, amazing company. Highly creative, and a nice mix of media and creativity, because in those days it was together in the same building. And my dad was with a bunch of people where they took media out of creative agencies, and you now have media independence and creative agencies working separately. So when I first started work at Gold Green East Trot when I was 19, my dad was at the height of his media fame, and campaign would report Yershin wins this or Yershin that. So I always went into my first job with this fearless feeling of everyone was the same. I treated everyone the same. There was a mix of fearlessness because I didn't feel any... issue with talking directly to a chairman or a CEO, and would equally converse brilliantly with postboys, because I came from a background of getting stuff done. And to get stuff done, you treat everyone exactly the same, and you're not hierarchical, and you treat people with respect, and you cut through the bullshit.
But you decided at an early age that you wanted to work in the industry.
Yeah, I'd had jobs in the early days, although my dad was highly successful and had amazing upbringing with him and my mum. We were never entitled, so I was working at age 13 in Petticoat Lane Market on a blouse stall. You know, I'd still have to get money in. I wasn't just handed money on a plate. So when I was 19, I'd gone to a college called St Godric's, which was a finishing school at that time, and there was a job going
in London,
in Hampstead, for nice young ladies.
Oh, very nice.
I think my parents thought that they'd try and kind of smooth out the edges.
A little bit different to Petticoat Lane.
Yes. Well, that's kind of like shows you the upbringing I had. It was
diverse.
Very diverse. Yeah. And you were supposed to work hard. Parents were self-made. They came from the East End. So it wasn't like everything was handed to them. They worked really hard. And so I guess that was my early days. And I always felt it was my dad that gave me that courage. But I since had gone on a journey, and my mum had passed away recently in the last couple of years. And actually, I realised that a lot of my strengths were from my mum and how she was with me, which was kind of brutally honest and would totally cut through any bullshit. And it was only really in the later days when I really got to know her much better, when I'd grown up that bit more and I'd done a bit of self-help with a course called I Discover, that I started to realise actually she played a really big role in helping me be as tough as I was, and especially the work that I was doing, which was about change. You had to have a thick skin. And especially the role that I had when I was at GGT, Gold Greenlee's Trot, you had to get things out of people. I was doing traffic, which is progress control within a large company. Make things happen on time, doesn't go over budget, the right people see it, get things done, in essence. And so people, you know, the creatives, they'd try to fob me off with things, and I'd have Dave Trot sitting in the corner office and I couldn't get away with saying they haven't done it.
For people that don't know about the legacy of Dave Trot, you want to just give a little bit of a oversight as to the genius of the man?
Dave Trot was is one of my mentors still, and a huge respect for him. He ran three different agencies, but the one that I was at was Gold Greenlee's Trot. And I think he went to Pratt Art School here in New York. So he's legendary creative, and you should read his books as well. He's done 3 books and some great blog posts.
Search for some of the great quotes of Dave Trot and be entertained for an evening.
But one thing was for sure is that it bred quite a few strong characters, where it didn't matter whether you were black, white, yellow, green, male, female, old, young, as long as you got the job done. So there was some amazing people that came out of that company over those years, because we were all equal.
Just to go back to, you talked about your mother and your father. If your mother injected a sense of brutal candor, let's say, and being honest and having integrity, what facets of your character do you think your father influenced?
Positivity, curiosity, anything is possible, fearlessness.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to come and talk about those in a bit more detail. Is there anything, I know you've talked about your early, moving into the ad industry fairly early on in your life. Is there anything that stands out as a defining moment in your youth or your upbringing? Had a seminal effect on your journey?
No, I think it was, there's nothing outstanding up until I hit going to work at an early age at 19. That's when all my growth, I feel, really started, because it was a brutal environment to start with, and I was only a kid, and I had this position as head of traffic at age 21. I don't even think Dave Trot knew how old I was, but I just held this position because I was able to work the system a little bit like a football team. So everyone had their position. So if you were in goal, do not come out and try and be a forward. And that's why it worked so well and so efficiently, because everyone had their role to play, and it was a well-oiled machine, and it was very much about team.
For anyone that maybe doesn't have a sense of what life was like in the ad industry, leaving aside New York, but certainly in London, and I knew about it from my early days in Edinburgh, that wasn't a time when there was much diversity and inclusion. Mm. And for a woman, I would have expected, as your first job, to walk into a very male-dominated environment where there probably wasn't a lot of respect for people's respect for the language that was used in different situations. It was, on one side, I think, of the industry, it was a bit of an old boys network, and the other, it was quite laddish as well.
Yeah, in Gold Greenleaf Trot, we were all very diverse, and Dave didn't worry as to what sex you were, how old you were. None of those things came into play. It was whether you were good enough for the job. So Cindy Gallup, Kate Bristow, Stevie Spring, myself, Kerry Millett, there are so many people that came out of those days working at GGT, very strong individuals and able to make things happen. And that was because of our training and our grounding with Dave.
Okay. You've gone from starting out in traffic, which is often at the entry level for someone finding their way in advertising and, okay, running the traffic department.
Yeah.
But to have gone from where you started to where you are now and had that either ardent ambition or vision, where did it come from, that faith in yourself?
I think it was, I didn't really think about it as faith. I'm a fixer. So if I can see something that needs to be done and I'm curious, I'll just say, well, why don't we do it another way? So I just got this reputation, unbelievable reputation of, I mean, if you want something done, ask a busy person.
Yeah.
So I just got given all of these different things to do, and it didn't even have to do with my job. It was just a case of I would just deliver upon it because I couldn't help myself. It was easy for me. I could spin many plates at the same time. And so what happened was, after years of working within traffic and then moving to Simons Palmer, and that was run by Carl Johnson, who runs Anomaly. So lots of us all came from School of Trot. And I then had two kids, and my maternity leave at that time was just 12 weeks. But I was allowed to come back part-time. And they were just merging with TBWA, and they wanted to move into a new building. And at the time, the chairman of Simons Palmer said, can you move us? Because he trusted, even though I'd never moved anyone into any building before, he just trusted that I could do it. So I did, because I've never taken a challenge that I'm not able to find the right people who know more than me, who can make it happen. It's just really a connecting role. I'm a kind of super connector.
Yeah, obviously from having met you before and knowing your reputation as well, that is one of your great superpowers. But when did your actual sort of sense of your own creativity and innovative mindset become apparent? Because you moved from something that was very production orientated into a completely different space in the industry.
Well, I was given the most amazing brief from the chairman at the time of Ogilvy, and that was in 2000. That was the start of kind of digital, needing to move from an analog world to a digital world. And the chairman at the time, he was chairman at Simons Palmer, and he knew me at Gold Greenleaf Trot. So again, I'd never done a CV. I just got phoned up just to say, can you help? And he called me at the time in 2000 and said, can you help move Ogilvy into the 21st century, move them from an analog world to a digital world? I've got no idea what it is that you need to do, but it's very civil service here with lots of paperwork, and it needs to change. And we're losing lots of money. Cash flow was an issue because it was all done on job bags and paper, and it needed to be really much more buttoned down. And that was my skill.
Yeah, there was no digital asset management at that stage.
No.
Yeah.
So it was then me going in, doing an audit for 3 months, seeing where, you know, the easiest place of where I could digitize, and that was workflow system, finance system, digital asset management system, digitizing all their archives going back to the 50s, then starting to do digital delivery, get rid of tapes, get rid of couriers. And so I systematically just started to see better ways of doing things. And that's then where my creativity really took hold, because I was able to see all these different companies out there doing different things and thinking, actually, that could work for us. So I'd seen a company called Beam, who were part of The Mill, and they were doing digital delivery. They hadn't even got a website up and running, but they were doing digital delivery of TV commercials. And I thought, well, why are we still sending tapes? And we did a business case as to, this is what you're spending now, and this is what you will spend if we change it. And they agreed for me to implement it. And that's just how I carried on in the early days at Ogilvy with their edit facility, and started to really look at how digital can make things quicker, better, stronger, faster. And then I slowly started to see, well, there's all these other things. There's something called Facebook, and there's gaming and mobile and social, and sending notes around to everyone, and some people kind of saying, stop spamming me, because they were too busy with their day job, and they weren't, it wasn't their job to look above the desk. You know, it was, they had to carry on as normal. I had the luxury of being allowed to be a maverick by the chairman at the time for probably 16 years.
And that maverick chairman himself was Rory Sutherland at the time?
He wasn't really a maverick. He tried things. Mm. So therefore could have a really good opinion, and he articulated it in such a way that people could understand. And that was kind of Rory's superpower. But he really understood what it was that I was trying to do, and he allowed me the space. It was a guy called Mike Walsh and Paul O'Donnell. Mm. Rory was the one that allowed me when they said to me, we want to set up an innovation lab, but there's no money. And I thought, oh, that's great, because I'll just find my own money. So I went to Rory and I said, Rory, you're really great at speaking, and what if I could be your agent and get you speaking slots in all these different places, and I'll charge for it, and the money I get for you to speak comes into my R&D lab. Brilliant. So then I have a pot of money to play with. And Rory was like, yep, that's great for me. So we started to build this pot of R&D money, and it always was never part of a P&L or profit and loss. Mm-hmm. It was always part of how can we experiment doing all these different things. And then I created these semesters of learning to have it, because there was so many things that were happening, and I was getting all tied up with everything being a shiny new toy. And so I created these semesters of learning to look at one thing in particular for 6 months. So streaming was our first semester of learning, see who was out there, see all these streaming companies around the world, attach it to business. A client at the time, Ford, had an issue where they wanted to do a live stream that went to 22,000 desktops in 19 countries in 5 languages. So I'd get the TV department to get involved, even though they said, we only do TV.
Yeah, and I can imagine there would be a little bit of pushback on that.
There was a lot of pushback. And the people that I didn't get pushback from were the ones that I pushed forward and did all of this kind of weird stuff with. It's not weird anymore, like, you know, saying let's do a upload that commercial or do digital delivery. People would scream at me and say, where's my tape? Mm-hmm. And I'd say, well, I haven't sent it, and I'm not going to send it, and just go to your post house and pull it down. That's normal now. And it was the same when I was implementing all these different things. It wasn't normal at the time to do augmented reality, to do 3D printing, to all of the projects that we undertook within a semester. They were being done for the first time.
It's interesting when you describe your journey through traffic and production, because at that time, it was still traditional media.
Yeah.
Where do you think your interest and your lack of fear for technology entered that allowed you to spot opportunities and problem-solving opportunities through technology when a lot of people wouldn't have? They would have been resistant to it. Yet you embraced it, not just in terms of the solving of the problem for the particular business operational standpoint, but you started to apply it into the creative domain itself, which must have resulted in some resistance from certain people as well.
There's a lot of resistance because people inherently don't like change because it's scary. Because it's never been done before. But I would find that a good challenge, because I knew once we could do it once, that means we could offer it as a solution for a new business model again and again. So therefore, once we'd done one stream and I'd prove that it could be done, a little bit like kind of an MVP, you're just proving that it can be done. So I'd created these 6 R's with a team of people to make sure that one of our measures of success wasn't just revenue but reputation. Mm-hmm. And so therefore I had to get that delivered and put it out there for awards and for PR, because reputation was part of the way that I was measuring the labs and keeping our jobs. Mm-hmm. So in some respects that was my KPI to make sure that it did get done. And we'd always put a stake in the ground with doing things that were new. So we would always make sure we'd attach it to, like, so with IBM and augmented reality, we attached it to Wimbledon. Now, that's not moving. It's always going to be the, you know, the last week in June, the first week in July. Yeah. And once you've said that's what you're going to do, you can't move those dates. So it's like Mother's Day or Father's Day or anything that is tactical always helps when you're looking to do something brand new, because you can't not deliver it.
What about, you mentioned the 6 hours. What were the other 5 hours? Well, there was reputation, there was revenue, the other
revenue,
4 hours.
Revenue, that was kind of like from Rory, or we did Rory's book without him actually writing it. So the Wiki Man. So it was when I was starting to get speaking slots for him, people would say, has he published? And I'd say no, but then he had published in Brand, Republic and Spectator. So I just talked to both of those magazines and then got all of his articles and then compiled them into a book. And then I was the publisher, so therefore I could charge for not just him speaking, but also for 50 copies of books for his delegates, or 500 copies of books. So that's how I fed my my revenue bit. So revenue,
reputation,
retention of existing staff, because they were doing really interesting work. Each semester, we would always make sure that the ones that were interested in big data or behavior change or whatever semester we were doing, they'd put their hands up, and then what they would do would be then spread the word. So they were our kind of like lab rats, if you like, and that's how we positioned it within the whole organization, not just a siloed lab. Mm-hmm. So retention of existing staff, recruitment of new diverse talent, which was a program called the Rough Diamond, which is what my books are. Responsibility, that's giving back. So there was some, do you know Dave Burrs, another Scottish?
I've interviewed Dave.
Oh, have you? Okay, so
gone live yet. Yeah.
Dave had a great idea along with a couple of others, and he had some beautiful ideas, but one in particular was Ideas Shop, which is where you give back to a local community. So the first one we did was in Brixton, where Ogilvy gave ideas away for free for all of the local community. So it was at a time where people didn't understand mobile optimization or SEO, and we would give away our ideas for nothing. So responsibility. And then relationships, that's the Black Book. Uh-huh. So from seeing all those different people each and every week, depending on the semester that you're working on, for the last 15 years, there's an enormous big black book of really good people doing some interesting stuff who know way more than I do.
Okay, I'm sure we're going to come and talk a bit more about your black book. There's a quote by a guy called Alan Saunders, which is, life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans.
Yeah.
What sort of serendipity, chance encounters, happy accidents or life events have occurred that have changed the course or direction of your journey in a significant way?
Lots of things, because that's how I live my life. I go to places where I know no one and nothing. So once you do that, you then make things happen by sheer power of pushing forward, and then coming up with an interesting idea with someone. So that could be you, for instance. You know, I reached out, I saw that you were doing the Impossible podcast. I knew I was coming to New York. I reach out to you. You say, that's great. And then we say as we do and do as we say. So you don't just say, yeah, that would be lovely, and never get back in touch with me. You're just as accountable as I am in making sure that we do as we say. And that's a reputational thing. So there's lots of things that happen serendipitously like that. But the one that did change my direction was when Ogilvy closed down the lab. The CEO at that time was more an Excel spreadsheet style CEO. And
was this in at the time when Ogilvy decided to integrate under all one brand?
No, well before, 2 years
before
earlier.
Okay.
No, this was when things weren't going great, and she just thought they could do without the lab. But she tried to sell a story to me and have me sign an NDA, and it was pay me off. The story was going to be Nicole in true entrepreneurial fashion is leaving Ogilvy, and we're so sad. And anyone that knows her will know she's always wanted to set up her own company and be an entrepreneur. And Ogilvy were going to be her first client. And I just said, no, I'm not. You're sacking me. What am I going to tell my team? They're all out of a job. But you're my client for 5 minutes just so you can sell this story. It's not the truth. And I would prefer to take no money and not sign an NDA, but go with the truth. And the truth is, you can't be seen to be an innovative company if you're getting rid of your R&D department, which everyone knows that was doing really, really well. Mm-hmm. But not well enough to get money in terms of how you were looking at it from the spreadsheet. So by making that decision, I then was starting to interview and also setting up my company, NYC, at the same time. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to take myself off to two random things. One is Hatch, which is in Montana, and the other was Summit. At sea.
Yeah.
So I went to one of the first summits at seas for a couple of years, and I knew no one and nothing, and just got onto this boat with 3,000 people, and it's like TED meets Davos meets Burning Man, and no Wi-Fi available, and it was very daunting, but a great atmosphere. Everyone's equal. There's no hierarchy, no VIP treatment. And I met a guy. I was in a jacuzzi. We were chatting.
As you do on a boat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he said, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm Nicole from Nicole." No more head of innovation. Yeah. And we started chatting. He said, "Oh my God, you've got some incredible stories. You need to write them down." I said, "No, I'm not a writer." He said, "No, I'm a publisher, and you're a woman in tech. You're kicking ass. They say no, you do it anyway. You've got some amazing case studies, you're a doer. You absolutely should get all these stories down." Now, had I taken the deal with Ogilvy, then I wouldn't have been able to freely then go about writing a book without worrying about lawyers and what could I say, what shouldn't I say. And I was able to just completely go through life with integrity and not have to lie to anyone, but I'd forget what I'd said to who. So I just, it was the easiest thing for me, was the hardest thing at the time, but then once I'd written the book, it was the easiest thing for me to just be candid and never mean, or I'm always gracious, but just honest.
The standard press release for agencies when they disband departments or fire people is always they've gone on to spend more time with their family or pursue their entrepreneurial interests or whatever.
Yeah.
But presumably you did have a strong entrepreneurial spirit. I mean, you were an entrepreneur, to use that term.
I was an entrepreneur. I was definitely an entrepreneur.
And that's just a case of then being released to go off and fulfill probably what was destined or in a burning ambition inside you. There must have been times when in the late 2000s when you're building up this amazing black book, you must have considered.
I think because I was a mum, I had two young kids, and you know what it's like with university fees or school fees or all of those kind of things. And having a monthly salary is the biggest addiction.
Yeah.
One of the biggest, like third biggest addiction, apparently. So I was allowed to be an entrepreneur within a large organization. So I was an entrepreneur. And when I left and I was kind of cut loose, it took me a good year to not worry every single month where the money's going to come in. And I got to the first year and my dad said, and we did well. My dad said, "Why are you worrying each and every month? You just get to the first year. It's a construct that people have forced upon you, this monthly thing, these monthly bills, you don't need to think of it like that. Just have you got to the first year and survived? Yes, you have. And then the second year, even better." So, but the first year was I didn't find mentally easy because I have a mortgage and bought the house off of my ex-husband and all the things that go with it being scary. But I kind of felt I was a little bit unemployable because I went on interviews at the same time and they'd all say they'd want, a head of innovation and to do this, that and the other. And I would then get more into the conversation and I would say, "Actually, what you need to do is this, this and this." And they would say, "Well, yeah, but we don't want to do that." And so I would say, "Well, then that's not the job for me. You say you want innovation, but you don't really." So I kind of felt that I didn't really have a choice but to open up my own consulting company to work with enlightened people who really did want to affect some change.
There's another quote I've used a couple of times. "It's not the circumstances that define you, it's your response." You sort of knuckled down, really. You just got on with it. So regardless of the fear of the mortgage payments, the kids, and the month to month, it didn't stop you. You could have been hired by many agencies willing to build their own R&D and innovation unit or gone in client side. But you chose to go down this route. You wrote the book and did that. What do you think got... Because we often reach those points in the road where many people will withdraw or step back from the precipice and be engulfed by a certain amount of fear. and not take what is a risk. I mean, of course, as you say, the first year, most businesses don't get it to that get to that first year. What was it that gave you that sense of belief in yourself?
I guess when I was working at Ogilvy and the job I was doing, it was nothing to do with marketing. And it was much more to do with business and creativity and strategy and business across the whole business, not just the marketing department, supply chain, comms. And that was something that was interesting me. And I found that agency, well, where I was working, they didn't really care to solve those problems. They just wanted to look at marketing. And so, to quote kind of John, who is one of my lab partners, my kind of black book partners, it's solving the wrong problem really well. And so I didn't feel I wanted to go into like jumping from a frying pan into a fire. Mm-hmm. And every conversation I had with an agency just felt like that. And I wanted to understand business in all its aspects. And so I kind of fell out of agency world, outgrew it or wasn't really in it. Like everybody else is in it, I wasn't an account man, I wasn't a planner, I wasn't a creative. I was this anomaly that just didn't really have a like a square peg in a round hole. So
it is strange that we find, and I'm sure John will have a lot to say about this, that we live in a changing world where the imperative for creativity to be applied to solving the really important big business, cultural, societal problems, there's never been a time like it for creativity to actually have its impact and for creative people to step forward and step up to the challenge. Mm. And agencies, wherever you go, will talk about the power of creativity to create genuine change, but seem to be stuck in the groove of still delivering creativity in its very limited domain, which is tends to be communication-based. Why do you think that is? Why aren't we seeing more examples of business-focused, real business transformational creativity? Not just, I mean, we could obviously, there's digital transformation, business transformation, and all the big consultants are selling their services for millions of dollars delivering that. But it's, I don't think there's creativity at the heart of it.
Yeah.
And what you're doing seems to be fresh and different.
Yeah. I think you can take it back to within the large organisations that are shareholder driven, it definitely can take it back to their business model. Their business model is, and similar to with consultants as well, is there to put as many bodies on it as possible and charge by the hour. And I disrupted Ogilvy's business model with something at one time, and I got into terrible trouble. But it was basically showing, actually, we just need, it was a Pizza Hut job, and we just need three people to do it, two people client side, three people agency side, no more people on the job. It's going to be done. There's no face-to-face meetings. There's no 10-page War and Peace contact reports. It's going to be done in literally 3 weeks. Everyone had a role to play. And when it came to the shoot, then there was only going to be the client there and the producer and director. And very, very specific about what was going to be shot. It wasn't just a 20-second ad. It was 15 other bits of content that were going to go throughout the whole organisation, including their internal comms. And it got to the first edit and there were no changes. And we made money because we didn't have to then put a new brief in, brief another creative team. That's another 100, whatever it is, by, you know, per hour for a copywriter and a art director. And there's so many people involved now. When they talk about working agile, you can't work agile when there's so many cooks.
No.
But that's their business model. And I got into terrible trouble with just trying to be, again, cutting through the bullshit and just being honest of I can see another way. Because I'm not looking at it from having to pay all those salaries and that huge building, which is why when, you know, I come to working with clients, maybe there's a different way to run your business. Maybe it's a leverage business model. Maybe you don't need such a big building. All these maybes. And it was funny, John and I were working with a very large agency where they said they want to innovate at the core. And we did, you know, due diligence and started to work out, you know, what does that even mean to you? Because you'd have five people saying five different things just because it's just a word. And then we'd find out, you know, who are their stakeholders, what do they want? And they couldn't even really define that. And then we went into different kind of business transformation. Maybe you don't have such a big building. Maybe you don't employ so many people. All these maybes. And someone around the table said, but this is business transformation. And we said, well, yeah, that's the question you asked. They said, but that's not what we don't want to do that. Which is good for us to know very early on. But it's sometimes they just keep saying these words. But transformation, and as I go into with my book, is not an easy thing. Doing digital delivery of TV commercials was not an easy thing.
You talk in the book about the Fearless Manifesto and touched on fear earlier, that clearly, and when it's coming up with new forms of creative solutions to solve business problems, whether you call it business transformation or digital transformation, you're always going to encounter fear.
Yeah.
Fear of the unknown, fear of what's going to happen to either the size of your business, the size of your department, sure, your balance sheet in the short term, albeit maybe from the long-term benefit. What can you just explain a little bit about the facets of your Fearless Manifesto?
I think we all know when we come across someone who's like-minded, it almost kind of feels like they're a similar tribe because they want the same thing that you want. And obviously it would be anarchy if everyone was like that within organisations. You need a little bit, it's like the De Bono hat theory, mm-hmm, a little bit of everything. But I think in times of change, which is what we're going through now, because it's all changing so quickly, you do need someone to say, but there might be another way, or to question things, or be curious, or to say why. And it's funny, in my book, I talk about the rough diamond scheme that I set up, because I specifically set it up because I wanted some of that fearlessness from kids who are about to be expelled from schools, because I'd noticed within Ogilvy that they were always hiring white middle class Oxford educated, and I actually, to do the changes I needed them to think maybe there's another way and question it and be curious and be a pain in the ass. So I set up Rough Diamond to get in those kids age 14 to 16 who, and I wanted the ones who were about to be expelled, and they were in areas of London, Greenwich, Tower Hamlets, Hackney, that were diverse thinkers. So they were used to being creative and getting out of issues. Maybe one of their parents was an alcoholic, or only one parent families, or all of these different things that weren't the usual way in which most people in the agency were thinking. And I remember setting it up or talking about it initially, and the chairman at the time said, "This isn't something I want you to do," and I ignored him. He said no, and I did it anyway. And 2 years later, we'd put this program together, which was amazing. And he came down to my office one day and said, "I've just had lunch with the Dean of Ravensbourne." So I said, "Oh, so, And he said that he's been working with you. And I said, "Yeah, we've done kind of this much stuff." And he said, "That was a really good idea of mine." It takes that fear. I could have easily been fired, but I knew for sure that that was the only way forward, to try and get an injection of diverse thinkers into that kind of organisation.
Yeah, because you talk about in the Fearless Manifesto the dawning of an alchemist, and I think that's the important facet, is to have the ability within an agency, a traditional network of like people that can create alchemy, turn the hands to anything, and do the unexpected.
Yeah. They used to hang them at the stake.
Yeah.
Or, used to burn them at the stake, rather.
Fortunately, you escaped before you got burned. So, or maybe you were just mildly burned. I'm going to go back and talk a bit more about curiosity, because I know you're known for your innovation, and that's a title that you've held, an R&D. But for me, I think it's your curiosity that seems to be the driver of your success in innovation. And what would your advice be to any parent or teacher is trying to instill more curiosity in their children or their pupils? Because you've obviously done it as well, you've had success with the teams you've built.
Yeah.
So there's got to be something you can pass on.
I think a lot of it is also to do with emotional intelligence. And I don't think people play to that strength. It's in schools, and it's to tick boxes. It's to get all these kids through and churn them out like a sausage factory. And if we go with, say, my son, who was about to be expelled from school pretty much every month, and my daughter, they didn't even know who I was because she was a straight A student. But he when I really kind of quizzed the headmaster, he wasn't actually doing anything wrong. He was just curious. And he would say, well, why and who says and how come? And but that was seen as disruptive. Like they say, sit down and shut up and I don't want to hear from you in 8 hours. But he couldn't do that because his personality is naturally curious. I think Seth Godin did a blog post about hunters and farmers, in that hunter mentality, naturally, if they hear a noise, they perk up and they're looking out the window and they're then told, sit down and concentrate. Mm-hmm. If there was a little bit of leeway with, though, there was an ounce of emotional intelligence with teachers or people within the work environment, they would understand that that's actually something to be embraced. Mm-hmm. And to give them a little bit more leeway to go and find some ways in which their creativity and curiosity can fix something. I mean, Max did really well in school in the end, but that's because I was on the case with his headmaster the whole time. But one thing that his headmaster was really good with, we'd found a teacher in the school who was a translator teacher, as in he understood Max and he understood the teachers. So therefore, if one of the teachers gave Max an issue, Max, rather than respond back and react back like cause and effect, he could take it to Mr. Wilson and say what had happened, and Mr. Wilson could say, but what the teacher really means is this, and then Max could say, oh, well, that's okay. So there was a language issue, and I found that I had exactly the same issues at Ogilvy. When I was at GGT, everyone spoke my language. I didn't even question that I was different. Everyone was like me. Same at Simons Palmer. We were the same. I went to Ogilvy and it was a very, very different style of organisation, and I felt I stuck out like a sore thumb. So I think understanding emotional intelligence and what's driving people to do what they do. I mean, we used to have tests all the time, and my strengths were, say, Gemma's weaknesses, and her strengths were my weaknesses. But you have to know yourself well enough to not be scared and to have a strong sense of self-esteem. And we would do things like emotional intelligence testing in times of the day. So one of our team was really struggling to get up in the morning, and rather than reprimand her or take it to HR, we just put her hours to starting at 11. Mm-hmm. And she flourished. So it's just having a bit of common sense, actually.
Okay. A couple of things that just made me think of while you were discussing that. I don't know if you've read the Noel Yuval Harari's book, 21 Rules for the 21st Century.
Yeah, in the process of, but not.
Yeah, well, I should remember what it is, but he talks about the four C's, the important facets of any education moving forward. And one of them, obviously, is creativity or curiosity that needs to be instilled in children to prepare them for the world we're moving into as we go through massive periods of upheaval and change and artificial intelligence. And also Ryder Carroll, the ADD sufferer, turned product designer and creator of the Bullet Journal. And he recounted a great story of how he was at school. He had one German teacher that spotted that when he was doodling, he was paying attention. Yeah. But when he was looking at her, his mind was elsewhere.
Yeah.
And it was only through this recognition of that teacher and then her being able to translate that behaviour to understand, did he then start to understand that what he was doing wasn't wrong, but it was actually just his way of learning. And that's led to him having this amazing bestseller called The Bullet Journal. So it's incredible when I can identify these translators. But
the shame of it is, just like with the work environment, is that they have fixed KPIs that don't allow them to take the trouble and the time to spot outside of that. Mm-hmm. So therefore, they're doing the marking, they're up late, they've got 30 kids, they're the same with agency life, they've got 2-hour journey to get to a meeting, they've got a meeting of 5 hours, they've got a contact report to do. There's no time to actually give to being curious or questioning something, because that's too, it's a pain.
This is probably quite a nice segue to bring in John when we're talking about creativity and innovation. In innovation in the broader business context, because it's a natural human behavior to resist change, and even if it's not fear of uncertainty, there's a certain resistance to it, and predilection just to continue to operate in the ways that have generated success in the past. John, how do you work with businesses to open up their, let's say, their neural pathways to opportunity and encourage them to see the possibilities and opportunities that are open to them through identifying maybe where problems lie that they haven't considered?
Yeah, it's such a good question. The technique I've found works most, in fact, always works, is to present them with their language displayed visually in front of them. So I kind of confront people with their own statement in terms of language, and I visualize that on a wall. And it, what tends to happen is when they're with their peers, they all see that they all don't share the same definition. So it's kind of a beguiling, charming way of getting them to realize that they don't really know what they're talking about. And quite often, and I don't mean that always mischievously, but quite often it is, because a lot of people will have built into their soundtrack things that they've learned over a long period of time. So we're talking here about behavioral change, aren't we? And overcoming the habits. And the only way I've been able to get people to change is by confronting them with the insanity of their statement. And it's as simple as that. Clearly, I'm working in a kind of systems thinking sense. So I explode the challenge for them way beyond their own remit and beyond their own part of their job and beyond their own organizational construct. So they start to see the adjacencies and the implications of their own bit of the puzzle until they see exploded in front of them the entire system of their operation. And then they realize even more why it isn't going to work. And then you've got them to the, I think it was back in the day, we all learned that a cancer patient doesn't ever recover until they fully realize they've got cancer. And it's a bit like that. So you get them to the trough of despond and then you build them back up again.
And how do you arrive at the point at which you can display, depict everything they've fed to you visually? That sounds like a fairly intense investigative process to deconstruct and to draw out of individuals within an organization their perceptions to their current reality.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it is true. We have to spend quite a lot of time forensically understanding the context within which they operate. I heard a lovely story recently from a chap called Conrad Wolfram, who's one of the world's top mathematicians.
Wolfram Alpha.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
And I was transfixed because he stood up in front of 400 people and said, "We've got to stop teaching our children maths." It was such an amazing moment. There he is, the world's leading mathematician at that time. And he said, what we need to do is teach them computational thinking. And so we all looked at each other and thought, what's that? And it's basically the art of deconstructing a problem into all of its constituent parts and then building them back up again. So he said, if you want to teach your children maths, he said, tell them that the big wheel and on the pedal is the bigger than the one on the axle, and they'll go this much faster, depending on how big the big one is and how small the small one is. And you think, that makes complete sense. And of course, that engages the brain. So we do a similar thing without realizing it, which is to abstract all of the bits of information, not in such a complicated way initially anyway, because they just wouldn't engage with it, but in a as simple a way as we possibly can on a framework, on a wall, which could be 100 feet long, and start to walk them through, step them through the logic of the fact that this isn't going to work if this isn't in place, and so on and so forth, until they realize there's no hiding place. So they just either have to change their mind or change the question that they're asking themselves, which is such a wonderful thing to do.
How do you decide, or how do the organizations decide the stakeholders that need to be within this process?
Yeah, great question. We start with an exam question, which is our method, our language for what is the question that's going to get everybody's attention and would dictate who needs to be there if we were to answer that question. And what's really fascinating about that is the question's often wrong, but the intent is right. So after they've noodled with that question a little while, they realize, well, actually, we need to bring different people in than we thought we were going to bring into this conversation. So I'm in New York this week with a client where exactly that happened. You know, we started with the exam question and they said we're going to be working with these 15, 20 people. And by the time we've been through the process of understanding the exam question properly, we're now at 30 people that are going to be in that room, which isn't always a good thing, but that's a different
answer. Who provides you with the question that you have to answer?
We help the client work that out. The presenting question is often we need to change our operation and be more successful and take this amount of money off the bottom line or, you know, whatever. But actually, the question should be just as much about what's getting in our way of being successful. So the art of writing the exam question has become quite critical for us. So we have to get a little bit of the prize, the motivational aspect of it in, but also make sure it allows us to dig at the root cause, because people are so, as Nick said, so busy doing the day job, mm-hmm. they forget actually what they're doing, and they've become so conditioned to coming up with the very professional answer, which is the wrong answer, because they can, because they've defended their position on it for so long, they've forgotten that the world's changed.
Or that's how they've been measured. The only KPI is financial.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. They're not. It's a really interesting thing, transformation and change, because businesses are built to be so resilient to change. Mm-hmm. They're not built to live in the world that we're living in now. So a lot of our work these days is getting people to realize that if they continue with the operating model that they've got right now, they're going to fall off a cliff. Mm-hmm. And they've got to stop building in resilience, because they're no longer going to be agile. You know, this is the balance that people have to get their heads around.
Do you get the sense that there, presumably businesses must be fearful of the disruptive innovators, to take Clayton Christensen's term, but at the same time, even where there isn't a disruptive innovator on the horizon, there must also be fear of just the lack of ability to change themselves? And where's the fear coming from?
Such an interesting one. I mean, we're working with massive organizations where, whilst they're fearful, mm-hmm. they lack a burning platform. So there's no driver to change, mm-hmm. so they don't. And I firmly believe that some of them will go out of business.
But they're coming to you, they must have a sense that there's something they need to do. So there's an impetus and a drive and a willingness to explore new pathways.
In many cases, yes. And that's taken an enlightened leader mm-hmm. to spot that they really need to do something before they fall off the cliff. Mm-hmm. Quite a lot of our work is with people that are just doing a tick box, ticking the box. You know, they've got to create a new report for this reason or that reason. And so that's a bit of a shame, because they're never actually going to implement the result of what we're doing, which we're trying to get much smarter at not doing.
Mm. That was what going to be my next question about what is your role in implementation of change?
Well, that's a really interesting one as well. I mean, the fact is we try to be completely impartial as to the outcome. So we try and say we deliberately do not want to be around to benefit from our advice to you, because that would be convenient for us. That's the consulting model. Uh-huh. Where it's very convenient for them to come up with a set of solutions that only they can answer. And because I was a client before I do what I do now, I found that completely unfair, and I couldn't get the impartial advice. Increasingly, we're asked to stick around because they realize that our integrity is there, and that we wouldn't have come up with an answer that was convenient for us. Mm-hmm. But it's such a subtle balance, that of getting that right. So we'll try and arm. And so here's another way of putting it. We try and transfer the capability for the future to the people that are in the business. How about that? Because it's their job. Mm-hmm. So whilst...
Can you say that again? We transfer the capability to...
Yeah, so we transfer the capability of their destiny and their future to them by arming them with the tools and equipment and techniques that we do as we go through the process. Mm-hmm. So they should, in theory, be capable of picking it up and carrying on with it. You asked some really interesting and very insightful questions earlier as to why we humans do not change, or rather do not solve the really complex problems that society mm-hmm. demands of us. And I think there's, I mean, we could talk for hours and hours about mm-hmm. that particular question alone. And a lot of it comes down to the fact that people have limited capacity or bandwidth to really think hard enough for it to change the neural pathway mm-hmm. that shifts their mindset.
Yeah.
Now, that's a neuroscience answer to your question, which is perhaps a bit too complex, but we do hardwire our habits, and it takes time and practice and learning and repeating. So when was the last time you changed your behavior?
Well, might not be the best person to ask about that, because I'm considering I've just been talking about BJ Fogg's Tiny Habits and how to go about changing behavior
but
and trying to do it myself. Yeah,
it's tough, right?
I radically changed my diet.
Well done.
At the end of last year.
Yeah.
There have been little ups and downs, but I'm pretty much on the track for maintaining that.
So you'd be in what we would call the more enlightened end of the spectrum. The vast majority of people in organizations that we work with, large corporates, big brands, you know, global governments, there's no motivation. As Nick said, you know, their KPIs are do that. We don't want you to be innovative. We don't want you to be disruptive, because to us that's risk. And we're not capable. And I guess the final point on this is that there is no guidebook for where we are right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we have to test and learn, and their organizations are not good with that. So
I agree with you, there's no guidebook, but that also applies at previous phases in history. I think the difference is it's the pace of the change that's happening
at
the moment that allows for maybe iterative development and learning. And organizations have been able to evolve at a pace in time, but the acceleration or the exponential growth, and I've seen a graph of something that looks at that means that most businesses are set to fail because they're just not going to be physically or mentally capable of maintaining the pace that they need to operate at, and which is why it supports Christensen's disruptive argument.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I was trying to do with Ogilvy, was doing these semesters, bringing the outside world in regularly by giving them other ways to make money, was my way of having them do more than just their usual TV and print.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was the only way that, because they weren't measured on what's going on in the outside world and being curious, that was my role, to bring the outside world mm-hmm. in
yeah.
To make it relevant to their business.
There's a quote, I think it was a Hemingway book, I can't remember which one it was, which is life happens slowly, then all at once. And I think that's the reality of what most businesses are facing. They know that the change is happening, but it might be happening slowly, and suddenly, before you know it, their business model's been disruptive. Their customer base is gone.
Organizations are complex things. I mean, there are processes. There are procedures, there are systems, there's infrastructure, there's people. That's a recipe for absolute disaster if you want to try and change all of that lot at any one time. And there are people who have got huge investment in the fact that they made the decision to put those systems in. So when it suddenly realize that those systems are what's holding the business back.
Particularly if they've come from a PwC or a McKinsey and someone's paid millions of dollars to
actually. Exactly, yeah. Just spent $6 million on that mm-hmm. piece of software, and now it's already out of date. You know, these are real things, and that takes real brave. That takes big balls to go and cut that out of the business. And so they don't. So there's huge factors and dynamics going on here, which are tough.
I'm going to ask you just a question that wasn't on my list, and applies to both of you. You read a lot today about the perception of Gen Z and millennials' expectation of businesses to be purposeful and to be, let's say, have a more philanthropic intent. Mm. What's your sense of that? Having worked with a lot of large organizations, and whether it be about helping businesses retain more staff of that generation or attract more customers, is this something you think applies to just that generation, or is it something that's just happened to, we've got more, there's just more written about it because purpose is in the ether?
From my experience, a couple of things, John, you can say your point of view, but I have a 23-year-old, and she went the route of university and got a first, and then she was going to go into corporate world and got a job as a graduate trainee, and lasted a couple of months and was crying and just said, I can't do this. I can't. They micromanage me. It takes me a week to get an email out. They change ands to the, and there was no feeling that they were doing anything worthwhile in her mind. She couldn't understand. She was almost thought she was missing something. I said, no, this is how it is. Mm. And so after much soul searching, I said, come with me and do the book launch for me. Take 10 days off from work and let's try and work out what what it is that you really want to do. Because she couldn't imagine having a life like that every day, day in, day out. And cut a long story short, kind of John did a wall with her and kind of came out with what she really loves doing, which is actually personal training and fitness and health. And so she's now she has a portfolio of things, as well as running her own gym and doing various other things. And she's loving it. She still has the emotional crisis of being an entrepreneur and where's the money coming in, but she's preferring it to working in industry with their rules and regulations. And she couldn't stand the 9 to 5, and why did you have to work in the office when you technology means that you could work outside? Mm-hmm. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is, look at everyone, there's so many in the gig economy, which means that people are not happy with how companies are treating them. And they think, you know what, we'll do it for ourselves. We'll be in control of our own destiny. And I've been following social philanthropy and social enterprise. There's a guy called Sir Ronald Cohen, who's a big investor in companies that make money, but by doing good. Mm. So they're not NGOs and they're not charities, but they are making money, but with a purpose.
Yeah, I think I'd just go to the other end of the spectrum just to make the answer to your question. I think there are more senior executives now who are realizing that if they don't get close to their customer, they will fail. And I think customers are becoming, that's all of us, right? Consumers are becoming so much more aware of issues. And if there's a choice for them to change to a business that has got more purpose, and for purpose we can read anything, you know, sustainability, helping mm-hmm. poverty-stricken individuals, whatever it might be, human trafficking. And there are some examples now starting to come out, some famous ones, where organizations have grabbed hold of an initiative, and we could call it cynical because it might be marketing, pure and simple, or it could be actually because there is a conscientiousness there at the leadership level. And we've been following Paul Polman over the last year.
Mm. Unilever.
Unilever. Mm. And even, you know, the lesser known, but big ones. I mean, the Danone CEO was very, also came out with some big statements on this. So I'm hopeful that more and more organizations, and particularly the more entrepreneurial and new businesses that are coming out, are trying very much harder to make this about the real world and about society and looking after their people and bringing more diversity and turning that into something that you can actually see that they're being real about. And we're based in Soho, so we see virtually every store down that part of town really trying to make an effort to.
Soho in London or Soho?
Soho in New York.
In New York, right.
So whether it be sustainability, there's a very interesting guy that John and I know called Justin Dillon, and he set something up called Slavery Index, and it was for everyone, any individual, to go onto that Slavery Index and say who they were, how they lived their life, and it would literally come up and say how many slaves you were employing today in modern day world. And what he's done is he's then moved that into large organizations, Walmart and Target, where it's like a SaaS platform where it can be added onto their organization and just show exactly where the issues are within the company and how many slaves they're employing. So it's not just sustainability and get the right materials, or this particular thing is human slavery, which is going on everywhere.
That's amazing. I'll check that out. I'll put that in the show notes. Mm.
Yeah, he's a great guy. So I'm hopeful.
Okay. Just building on that, one of the questions I like to ask guests is if you were handed the keys to the mayor's office, that could be mayor of London, mayor of New York, or even better, the White House or Downing Street. What would be the key changes that you would start to make to improve the future opportunities for people?
God.
Don't start with the White House. That's too easy.
We need an easy That's question just, in there.
you've got to start off with things that are easy to change initially. So not these big, huge gestures, but just small things that you can change. I've always found in the area that I've been working in, not that I can even think of what it would be like running a country, etc. But you do a lot of small changes and you turn around after a year and that you can absolutely notice the change. You can't do the big changes. They just end up paralyzing you. But if you can do the small changes, little and often, that then leads to serendipity, alchemy, meeting someone else who can help you do something else. And before you look round, you kind of have made a big dent in society.
I think a few years ago, I was hopeful that technology was going to change the way in which we did voting and leadership and government, and that we could all have a much fairer vote. And I think the one thing that we've got to change coming up is the way that politics works. Personally, in the UK, it's been a while since you've been there, but I'm sure you've kept up.
Oh, of course.
Well, with what's going on.
Actually, I mean, with the Scottish vote for independence and with Brexit, yeah.
Exactly. So I think we're suffering from, I used to call it the unholy trinity, which was politics, media, and business. We're all kind of in this deadlock where it suited the media to be plus or minus at any given time to just sell newspapers and newspapers. I'm being very generalist with this. Governments would try and keep business happy and they'd have to try and keep the media happy, so nobody won and nobody knew where they were. And in the last couple of years, certainly in this country, with fake this and fake that and very cynical attempts to gain power through, corrupt means. And as Nick said, that's a big thing. It's not a little thing, but there are ways in which you could tackle little things. And I think it doesn't encourage leadership to go into politics. And I don't want to get into political discussion here, but to me, it comes back to leadership, mindset, the conditioning of whole areas of society, which if I could do anything about that, that's probably where I'd start.
I'd love to see a wall. One of your walls. That's the term for it, isn't it?
It is, your wall.
I would love to see one of those with the questions being asked of you by a leader of one of the countries in question.
Well, it's interesting. We're doing something, but if you find anybody that would like to do that, I'd do it for nothing.
Yeah. Even a city, I think it would be fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely right.
I'm going to interview a mayor, Councillor Kenyatta Johnson, I'm hoping, in the next month or so, who is councillor, obviously, on the mayor's team in Philadelphia. And they're a city just like Chicago with massive problems of, obviously, opioid crisis. Yeah. Gun crime, lack of opportunity. So if I can make an introduction there, I think that would be a very interesting conversation to have. So we'll keep that one.
Yeah, absolutely. These are important issues.
I'd like to do some quick fire questions quickish. And you can both answer these. What principles do you stand by?
Integrity, honesty.
Okay. John?
Wow. I was probably going to steal a couple of Nick's, actually.
What hard choices have you had to make that might have been pretty tough at the time, but turned out to be the right decision in the end?
Divorce. At the time, I'd been with my childhood sweethearts from when I was 14. So got married early, had kids early, and I probably should have got out of it sooner. But you don't know what you don't know, and all you know is what you've grown up with. And it wasn't until going through 3-4 years of this on his roller coaster that I then finally had the courage to say okay, no more, and stuck with it. And 6 months later, 8 months later, I just realized it was the best thing that I ever did. And fear held me back, fear of the unknown, but never went through lawyers, never badmouthed him, always kind of was very gracious. But that was, for me, probably a defining moment of breaking away from a small-minded, different kind of suburban world into just opening myself up to being a global citizen, I guess.
I think my answer to the early one, by the way, was probably in the area of creativity, generosity, decision-making, and decision quality, if I could put it like that. The things that I've done was leaving businesses when I got comfortable, when it was just too comfortable. So I was told I was going to have a corner office and a bigger car, and the following day I went and resigned. And
that's a very hard thing to do, because most of us seek comfort.
Yeah, I've never been comfortable. If I can't change the room around every 5 minutes, I'm not comfortable with. Mm-hmm. I just have to make change happen, because it's just that's
in your DNA.
In my DNA, yeah.
And I suppose that's where your serendipitous journey's taking you, to actually be a change maker for organisations.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
John is definitely around the thinking and the strategy, and the reason we work so well is I'm about the doing. But there's no point doing if you're fixing the wrong problem.
Mm-hmm. And there's no point having a great strategy without the doing.
Yeah.
Interesting. Perfect partnership. Where do you go, or what do you do to discover new ideas, or when you need space to think?
Come to New York. No, seriously, we spent the whole day today just wandering around from cafe to cafe and graffiti to graffiti, and just being hugely inspired by people watching and a city that is vibrant. And all the shops, especially downtown in Soho, everything is different. Everyone is vying for your attention in the most creative way.
I think we have been lucky to travel to some of the most crazy parts of the world, like, the wrong side of the island of Cuba, Vietnam, with all of its crazy, if you've ever been to the Far East, it's just mad. And just, being on safari this year and sitting in an island with nothing around, all of those different stimuli. Just do it for me. Mm-hmm. And avid reading stuff that I shouldn't be, or clicking on things that are just not naturally the first thing to click on. It's like doing things just because they just wake you up.
I think I know your answer to this probably, Nicole. Who are your greatest influences and inspirations?
I would say my dad, Mike Yershin, and Dave Trott. But actually my kids, because they've taught me so much about myself. And you don't know how to parent, you don't get a parenting manual, and it's been an incredible journey just being around them and having to learn different ways to handle them. I mean, I've been very lucky with the jobs that I've always done. Has always been about getting things out of people that don't want to do something, whether it be in traffic and you need someone to do some copy or write, draw something up, and they've got other things that they want to do, but I know that that's got to be done. So you get very used to trying to work with human beings into how to get the best out of them. So I always find people fascinating. And I always like looking out for people who fill me with energy. It's almost like a huge boost of, wow, that was incredible. That for me is exhilarating, when I find people like that, my tribe. And you could see them twice in a week or once in 2 years, and you'd still get the same buzz.
Okay. John?
Roger Martin, who was the Dean of Rotman School of Business, who coined the phrase design thinking.
Ah, right, okay.
And integrative thinking and a lot of other thinkings. And whether it was him or not, he kind of took a lot of credit for it. And he wrote a great book called The Designer Business. My art teacher back at school when I was 11, who took me under his wing and made me realize it was okay to still be drawing on a piece of paper after the age of 11. Mm-hmm. Unlike many kids get told to put the crayons away, he just told me to get them out. Jean-Michel Basquiat, actually, just a great inspiration. And I guess John Lennon just wrote the most incredible things for me and made me realize that it was okay to like music and the arts and creativity and just be a bit out there and do stuff. So people like that.
It's a question I probably shouldn't be asking you, Nicole, but how do you keep up with technology, whether it be personally or in business?
It's really easy for me, thank goodness, because I just find where nobody else goes and then just take myself off and just say yes and deal with the consequences after. And I always find, because I'm an optimistic person, I'll just always make the best of those kind of situations. So I follow certain people, whether it be on social media, Twitter, LinkedIn, whatever, that nobody else really follows, or I'll see something in someone that no one else really sees. And I have an amazing connector memory. So I could see something 6 years ago or meet someone 6 years ago and be given a problem, and my brain just immediately connects it.
Great talent to have.
Yeah.
Technology? Yeah. Well, I was lucky to go to, I was in Cambridge at the time when the microcomputer industry kicked off in the UK. It was a real privilege working with people who became quite rich and famous.
Some real legends there.
Real legends, yeah. And the BBC microcomputer, I was responsible for launching that along with, you know, the senior executives of that business, which is a real privilege. But more interestingly, we actually spawned another company called Arm Technologies, which created the chipset, which is in a lot of mobile phones. And it was just, we didn't know what we were doing at the time, but it became an incredible story. So I was very privileged. And I would probably be I have every gadget known to man. I mean, if you visit my apartment in London, which you must, you will see everything moves and you can speak to everything. And it's just a joy, really.
It's curiosity, and we're always looking for how can you do things different or better, and so we're always on the lookout for, well, that could be interesting. And we'll always try something. So when before even people were talking about Alexa or voice control, we already were using it and working on it just to work out, well, does it work, or does it work for us, or is it relevant? Is it a waste of time? Is it better for me to just get up and turn the light on or off? And it's amazing how once you use something, you then can have an opinion.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Very true. I could talk at length about that as well, but then I'm going to get into the last couple of questions. The impossible question: what would your advice be to someone, let's say 20 years, 25 years behind you, that's got a dream, a goal, a grand ambition, but has been told by either their peers, their parents, or whoever, people around them, that that's impossible, you'll never do that?
Well, nothing's impossible. If that person has a strong enough sense of self, they'll be able to do anything that they want to. I really do believe that. And if they connect the right dots and go to the right people, they're with the wrong people.
Build one of those black books.
Yeah. It's really difficult when you're younger. I see how my kids are with social media, and they don't like it in terms of they feel uncomfortable or... fuck it, just put yourself out there. What's the worst that's going to happen? That you get rejected? So what? Get on with it and just keep battling away.
Didn't Dave Trott have a great quote about rejection? He said, if you can't accept rejection, you'll never make any progress, I think it was. Something
exactly.
Like that, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the right answer. Go and prove them wrong.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If anybody tells you that. And that means you're on to a winner, probably. If the people who are 20 years older or 30 years older than you tell you that's the wrong thing to do, it's probably the right thing to do.
Yeah, teenage rebellion. They'll say black, you then say white.
Sounds good. What book should we offer our listeners for the best comments in the comment section?
Oh, God, I have...
Now, obviously, we're going to be offering one called Rough Diamond by a person called Nicole Yershin, published recently. But if there was another book that someone should read that you felt would arm them to be in a better position to face the future?
Oh God, that's really put me on the spot, because we have so many books on the go, don't we, at home, that we'll read a bit, put it down, then something else looks good and we'll pick that up. And I think actually just there's not one particular book. It's like saying listen to one piece of music. There's just so many things out there. Find something that is going to really make you feel, that's going to give you that buzz. And just then it's almost like the Amazon. If you like this, if you read this, then you're like this. Just be open-minded to try a few different things.
Roger Martin's book.
Okay.
The Design of Business. Fine. I'm pretty sure it's that way around, or The Business of Design. I think it's The Design of Business.
Great, that's on the list. Who should we interview next?
Justin Dillon, who did the Slavery Index.
Okay.
He's such a legend. I saw him in New York, not last year, the year before. He was pushing forward with his book, and I was just on, you know, beginning to do my book. But he is a brilliant guy, isn't he?
He's a brilliant guy. I would interview Yves Bergquist. He's based out of LA.
And what does
he do? He's a rock star AI genius, basically. Mm. Check him out. We've had the privilege to come to know him over the last few weeks. And I won't say any more about what we're working on because it's classified.
Okay. But
lovely guy. And I could sit and hear him talk about AI, and he'll make it relevant to every conversation we've had tonight.
That would be fantastic. So I look forward to
Andre Angel.
Oh wow, yes. We're getting a list here.
Yeah. I'm not going to give you all my black book contacts.
No, but that's great.
We did so bad answering all the other questions. Yeah. We're doing well on this.
I will ask you for a connection to Justin, to Eve, and if they're not available, then maybe Andre.
Yeah, it'd be a pleasure.
I'd just like to finish to say thank you very much for your time. I appreciate you're on a working vacation, busman's holiday, whatever we say in the UK. But I started the conversation saying, Nicole, I'd known you for a long time and respected your enduring optimism, your integrity, as you said, and the courageousness to do what you've done for your career in a big agency like Ogilvy. And what I feel now is that I'm left with a sense of your resilient, restless pursuit of driving positive progress and transformation is really what your story and your journey has been about. And it feels to me like you're just on the next chapter. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what NYC does beyond NYC.
Yeah, me too. I'm just getting started.
Yeah. And obviously with John, what you're doing with your visual problem solving and telling the future stories of businesses is also fascinating, and I look forward to learning more about that as well. And if people want to check you out and find out more about what you're doing, where shall they go?
Well, I'm really lucky because there's only one Nicole Yershin. As
That's
in, my parents obviously understood SEO and the internet. So everything is under my name.
And if you went to my website, it's grouppartners.online or .net, either will get you there, and it's kind of fun.
Okay, look forward to that.
Really enjoyed your questions. They
were great. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks very much, guys. Okay, folks, that's it for this week. If you like the show, please subscribe, and ideally give us a 5-star rating and a review, because it helps more people discover us. Just go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to subscribe and rate. For now, stay curious, be creative, and be open to serendipity. See you next time.